You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12s. This is Corbin Smith, host of the Locked On Seahawks podcast, alongside Rob Rang. Yesterday, we were proposing some trades, and, well, Christmas has come early because several trades happened today, including one involving the Seahawks. We'll open up the show with analyzing Seattle's Big Tuesday trade. The secondary has created quite a quandary for the Seahawks, so they made a move to bolster the group. In the second quarter, it's Throwback Tuesday. We'll look at some former Falcons that were also standouts for the Seahawks. And then we'll conclude the show with a few quick takeaways from Seattle's 30-16 loss to Baltimore on Sunday. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. Earlier today, the 49ers made a monster move. They added Emmanuel Sanders, a guy, Rob, that you actually mentioned the Seahawks should have some interest in acquiring, and they got him from the Broncos. Deciding to get involved in the NFC West arms race, the Seahawks countered that move by trading a 2020 fifth-round pick to the Lions for veteran defender Quandre Diggs and a future seventh-round pick. Initial thoughts on this trade?
I like the move. I think, to me, this is Seattle going back to its roots. I mean, while some teams are looking for offense, Seattle, you know, and Pete Carroll is going to go back on defense. And Quandre Diggs is a versatile player. He's an instinctive player. To be honest with you, he kind of reminds me of Ugo Amadi, except unlike Ugo Amadi, who's obviously sitting here in his rookie season, Quandre Diggs is a guy who has already proven his ability. He was a Pro Bowl alternate a year ago, basically for giving away peanuts. I think that this is a potential slam dunk for the Seahawks, and I think that this is a move that absolutely eases the concern in the secondary.
This move, I think, is a brilliant one for a number of different reasons. I'm just going to start off with the fact that he's 26 years old. He's a fifth-year veteran in the prime of his career, and he's under contract through 2021. This is not a rental piece. They are acquiring a guy that's got starting experience at two different positions. He started at nickel corner in 2017, and then they moved into strong safety. He really is that jack of all trades. Like you mentioned, Ugo Amadi, he's very similar, a jack of all trades, not necessarily a master of any of them, but he's a very good football player. He was, like you said, a Pro Bowl alternate last year. This year's been a little tougher for him. He's missed some tackles. He hasn't been 100% healthy, but from the sounds of it, he's been able to turn the corner health-wise here. He's a defensive team captain for the Lions, so there's a reason some of the former teammates, I guess we can now call them, of his were on Twitter today showing their displeasure about this move. This was a very popular guy on the field and in the locker room, so the Seahawks are bringing in somebody that's going to help from the leadership standpoint immediately. I know there are several players in the Seahawks that have a close relationship with him anyway, so this should be a really natural fit for him coming to Seattle. I'm just really curious where the Seahawks are going to fit him in right now, though. There are some injuries that they're dealing with. Bradley McDougal still has back spasms he's working through. Lano Hill is going to be out a couple weeks minimum with an elbow injury. And this is a guy, like you said, he started at slot corner. He has started at strong safety. I think he can play the free safety position too in a pinch. He ran a 4.56 40 coming out of Texas. He's got really good range. He's instinctive. And I think the thing I really love about him playing back there is, you know, he's going to get to the football and then he's going to smack somebody. This guy likes to hit people. And given how Tedrick Thompson has struggled, this is a move that I feel it had to be made. If they were able to get him for, like you said, peanuts, trading away a fifth-round pick to get a player that's a really solid safety in this league, they had to pull the trigger here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, to me, this is a credit to the Seahawks pro scouts. I mean, obviously, general manager John Schneider as well. But I think this is a player that Seattle has had their eye on for a while. And once that they made the decision that they were going to be looking for defensive backfield help, then it might surprise people, considering that Detroit has struggled a little bit this year. But at the same time, Detroit has one of the more solid depth charts, especially at the safety position. So, you know, this was a player that was a little bit vulnerable, I think, in Detroit, just because he was not drafted by Bob Quinn, the general manager there. And so he was a little bit of an outsider looking in a regard, at least in some way. And that's unfortunate, because he is a good football player. He is very popular with his teammates, as you mentioned, as he was at Texas. And he kind of fits in with what Seattle's looked for. He had some struggles, kind of growing up. He was the younger brother of Quentin Jammer, a longtime Texas standout, an NFL standout. The Seattle loves the whole idea of athletic bloodlines and players for just seems like they often are coming from the great state of Texas, which of course produces so many good football players. He just kind of fits in with what Seattle has wanted in the past. Yes, he's short, 5'9" and a half, but he's also a rock solid 200-pounder. And as you mentioned, Corbin, he will smack you. I think that he also has the ability to play that free safety position. I think that he is going to be competing for real playing time early and perhaps be a starter within a week or two once he kind of learns Seattle's system. And that's the thing. I don't think that it's going to take him very long to learn Seattle's system, because that was the one thing that I had in my notes going back to his days when he played corner primarily at Texas, is what an instinctive player he is. Not necessarily the quick twitch athlete, but I made the comparison a little bit to Ugo Amadi before. To me, there's also some Bradley McDougald here. I mean, Bradley McDougald played cornerback at back at Kansas back in the day before he made that transition to safety. That's exactly what Diggs has done as well. So, I'm a big fan of this move, especially because you didn't have to give a lot to get something potentially big in return.
When Bradley McDougald is healthy, we saw what Marquise Blair can do, a little bit of a glimpse of what he's capable of. Pete Carroll was raving about his play in his first start. We talked about on the show yesterday. You're going to have both those guys and Diggs available. I think this is also a sign that they're going to be playing more nickel moving forward, because Diggs can play that slot corner position. You could see more of that big nickel package, and this is a guy that, like I said, he'll come up and he'll stick you. He had 6 interceptions the last 2 seasons. He hasn't gotten his hand on a football yet this year. Again, there's been some health issues early in the season. He still started 5 games for the Lions. I wouldn't be surprised if he's playing significant snaps this weekend against the Atlanta Falcons. We talked about this yesterday a little bit, especially if Matt Ryan doesn't play. This is a perfect game to try to get somebody acclimated to a new defense in Seattle. There's a reason they're 1-6. So this would be a good game to get Diggs in and just kind of get him used to his new surroundings, get him some snaps. Maybe he doesn't start in this game, but looking at his contract over the next couple years, it just doesn't strike me as somebody that they would trade for if he's just going to kind of be a reserve piece. I think that he's going to have a starting position ready for him. They were looking at him as a guy that can be an impact player that can immediately help their defense as they try to contend with the 49ers in the NFC West.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, too, is if you do a little research and you look at what, as you mentioned, his former teammates and the media in Detroit, what they're all saying about this deal. I mean, there's a lot of negative thoughts in Detroit right now with the Lions opting to trade Diggs out. And, you know, while sometimes the media out there in some of the analytics and things, I think in, you know, maybe not aren't necessarily quite as accurate as fans might think, but at the same time, when you have just such a opposition to a trade from a fan base, from a media market, from analytics, from everything, then I think that kind of bodes well for the future. You know, just because of the fact that Diggs does seem, again, like such a great fit, and frankly, it looked like he was beloved by most in Detroit. So a surprising move. We talked about some of the trades that we anticipated might happen for Seattle, and you know, we mentioned some defensive backs. This is a player that I never really considered, because I just didn't think that this was a player that Detroit would be willing to move. But at the same time, I'm happy that Seattle was able to get him, because I think that he does fill an area of concern. And again, you didn't have to give up much to get him.
We talked about this a little bit before the show. I actually was considering putting his name down. I was kind of shocked that it actually happened today when we were discussing trade proposals yesterday. And I thought, the Lions are right in the mix, been in every game, and they've lost a few games they should have won. They're not going to trade away one of their captains. Well, it turns out, sure enough, they did. So you just never know in this league. Everybody's got a price, and I'm just surprised they could get him for a fifth, because I do think he's a really good player. The versatility is going to fit well in Pete Carroll's defense in Seattle. The folks at Roman, a men's health company, are changing the game with Roman Swipes, the secret to longer-lasting sex. Get $10 off your first order of Swipes and free 2-day shipping at GetRoman.com/LockedOnNFL. After a quick break, Rob and I will partake in our favorite segment of the week. It's Throwback Tuesday. Don't go away. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Welcome back, 12. This is the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm Corbin Smith alongside Rob Rang. Later in the show, we've had a chance to watch the All-22. Rob and I are going to share a few quick takeaways from Sunday's loss to the Ravens. But before we can revisit that game, It's Throwback Tuesday. We do this every week. We'll take a look back at some players from earlier eras who were also stars on the upcoming opponent. This week, it's the Falcons. So we're going to get to talk about one of my all-time favorites here. We'll wait a few players here, though, first, because there were several very worthy candidates this week. A lot of players that were really impactful ones for the Seahawks and the Falcons.
Well, yeah, and I think that we have to start off with Eugene Robinson. I mean, there's been so much talk about Bobby Wagner and the fact that he is chasing Eugene Robinson to overtake the former number 41 to be the Seattle's all-time leading tackler. And Eugene Robinson was just such a good football player for Seattle and in Atlanta. You know, just kind of we talked before with Quandre Diggs about an emotional leader, an instinctive guy, a ball hawk, a big hitter. I mean, that Eugene Robinson was all of the above for Seattle. So to me, that while there are several good players that deserve mentioning here, he's the one that immediately jumped to my mind as far as a former Seahawk and former Falcon who played at a high level for a long time.
The thing that I always loved when I watched Eugene Robinson, and I was really young when he was still playing with the Seahawks, but I do still remember his ball hawking ability. And I was actually, this is how long I've loved football, those that are listening. I was 4 years old in 1993. And Eugene Robinson had 9 interceptions. I still remember, and that team was not good. They were better than 1992. Robinson just flying all over the field, racking up a bunch of tackles. He had 111 that year, also had 9 interceptions. We talk about this every week, it seems like, but there was so much talent on the defensive side of the ball for those Seahawks teams in the early and mid-90s, and unfortunately, they didn't have the quarterback on the other side, so weren't able to win a ton of games. But Robinson's a guy that was a second team All-Pro that season and made a couple Pro Bowls. I think he would have made several more Pro Bowls if he played on better teams. The peak of his career was in the early 1990s to mid-1990s. And again, the Seahawks just weren't very good during that time, and that hurt a lot of those guys trying to make Pro Bowls and earn All-Pros. But this is a guy that had 42 interceptions in 11 years with the Seahawks and 983 combined tackles. Bobby Wagner, like you mentioned, very close. I think he might pass him this next week against the Falcons and take over as the Seahawks' all-time leading tackler. But Robinson held on to that for a very long time. He's been their leading tackler for a good portion of the franchise's history and definitely one of the best players they've had. They've had a ton of great safeties, and he's right up there with all of them.
No, he really is. I mean, and you said that the 42 interceptions in 11 years in Seattle, and it's 57 interceptions over his entire career. I mean, he played 16 years in the NFL. I mean,
he has a Hall of Fame resume. We've said that before on the show.
He really does. I mean, it's phenomenal. And I don't think that he gets enough attention, enough credit for what he did. So just a terrific ball hawk. And as you mentioned, Corbin, if he had been on some better defenses, if he perhaps played in a more prominent market, then I think that he would be getting a little bit more of that attention. It's kind of a guy who maybe played an era too soon. If he was playing today's era where everybody's throwing the pigskin around, I mean, who knows how many interceptions Eugene Robinson could have had. So I think a timely player to mention to start off in terms of just the ball skills and the fact, again, that Seattle made the splashy trade to get Quandre Diggs, as we talked about in the first quarter.
Robinson closed out his career with the Falcons, and we're not going to mention the incident he's best known for there. 1999, he was with the Falcons. He made a Pro Bowl in 1998, the last Pro Bowl of his career, and unfortunately, before that Super Bowl, had an incident that I still think that looms over Hall of Fame voters that would consider him, whether fair or not. He made a big mistake, but at the same time, had an outstanding career, and I think he deserves to be in Canton, and unfortunately just hasn't gotten there to this point. Now let's swing to the offensive side of the football. Our second guy today, the Seahawks front line in the mid-2000s, that was one of the best offensive lines I've ever seen, Walter Jones and Steve Hutchinson being the anchors on the left side. But they had other guys on that line that were really good players as well, and one of them was Robbie Toback, their starting center, one of the best centers the Seahawks have had in their franchise history. He's actually one of those rare players that played in Super Bowls for multiple teams. He was a starter for the Atlanta Falcons, along with Eugene Robinson, in that 1998 Super Bowl against the Broncos. They lost that game, but both those guys were starting for the Falcons. Toback ended up going to Seattle in 2000, didn't miss any starts from 2001 to 2005. Very durable for the Seahawks. Finally got to a Pro Bowl in 2005 on that Super Bowl team, and just one of the more underappreciated offensive linemen they've had, and part of it just being there was so much star power next to him on the left side of that line.
No, absolutely. I think he did get overshadowed for, you know, by Steve Hutchinson and Walter Jones there, and, you know, for good reasons. Those are two Hall of Fame players. But at the same time, Robbie Toback to me was a terrific player. I mean, just his quickness, his instincts. I mean, you don't not necessarily think of instincts often for offensive linemen, but his ability to kind of anticipate the blitzes and adjust was one of the things that I always appreciate. I remember watching him back when he was at Washington State, and he didn't play there his entire career. I believe he was a junior college transfer, but he was a guy that kind of immediately stood out because Washington State, while they've had some good seasons, there's been plenty of bad seasons for the Cougars as well. But Toback's quickness immediately kind of jumped out to me, and then just kind of followed his career. And so I was pleased when he wound up in Seattle. And as you said, I mean, he was a part of Seattle's first Super Bowl run. So he was definitely a player to remember because of what he was on the field, but also what he was off the field. I mean, just a very personable player. One of the very few players, or former players, I should say, that I actually follow on Twitter. It might have more to do with his fishing prowess.
I was just
going to
mention
else.
That. Yeah, I don't know that I see many football posts from him on Twitter. It's usually him holding a fish.
Exactly. So my kind of guy in that way, and of course he spells his first name wrong, but otherwise it's pretty close to the right way.
I can't share some of the stories that I have heard, but he was one of the goofier guys the Seahawks had on that Super Bowl team in 2005, and I'm sure Matt Hasselbeck has shared some of those stories publicly as well, but certainly had a sense of humor, and you mentioned him on Twitter as well. He's an interesting follow, and sometimes he'll just post some really random stuff too. So one of the former players that I still do pay really close attention to some of the stuff that he puts on. It entertains me, but let's close out this section real quick. One of my favorite players to ever wear Seahawks uniform, and he only played 3 years in Seattle, but he had arguably the best season of any defensive end in franchise history, and that's up against all those great years that Jacob Green had and some of the other players Seattle's had. Patrick Kearney, who spent his first 8 seasons with the Atlanta Falcons, he had 58 sacks in those 8 years, 3 years with double-digit sacks. Somehow he only made one Pro Bowl. That tells you how much talent there was with edge rushers during that time period, but comes to Seattle in 2007, 14 and a half sacks. He's a first team All-Pro selection, and he's a Pro Bowler. Unfortunately, injuries ruined his last couple years in Seattle, and then he retired. But this is a guy that, at least that first season, he was the premier edge rusher in the NFL for the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, as you mentioned with Eugene Robinson, unfortunately, because of a mistake, you know, it kind of casts a shadow a little bit over his long career. With Patrick Kearney, it was the injuries at the end and during his time in Seattle that I think has allowed people to kind of forget how dominant he was in that 2007 season. As you mentioned, 14 and a half sacks. He started all 16 games. It was the only season in his 3 in Seattle in which he did start every game. It wasn't just the 14 and a half sacks. He had 60 tackles, 16 tackles for loss, 26 quarterback hits. That's almost double what he had in the other 2 seasons combined. So, I mean, it just was a phenomenal first year, and I think he just kind of whetted everybody's appetite and thought, okay, what's he going to do next year? And unfortunately, shoulder injuries kind of caught up with him. But a phenomenal career, starting off with Atlanta, winding up in Seattle, wound up playing for 11 years overall, and had a total of 82 and a half sacks. I mean, I'm not a mathematician, but 82 and a half sacks in 11 years is a pretty solid average. I think something that a lot of Seahawks fans right now wish that they had a couple of defensive ends who were averaging 7.5 sacks a year.
The other thing I always remember about Kearney, and this is even dating back to his time in Atlanta, he was an outstanding player in playoff games. He had 3 sacks in his first 4 games for the Falcons in the playoffs. And then one of the better games I've ever seen from a defensive end that didn't actually get a sack, when the Seahawks beat the Redskins in the wild card round during the 2007 playoffs, he had 7 tackles and 4 quarterback hits. He was constantly back there battering the quarterback, but just could not get a sack. He was so close multiple times. And it was one of the more, like I said, one of the more dominant performances I've seen from a player that when you look at the stat, you're like, he didn't get a sack? How? I mean, he was back there massacring the quarterback the entire afternoon. So that was a game that always jumped out to me. And unfortunately, the next week in Green Bay, he had a pretty quiet game. And from there on, had some shoulder issues, as we mentioned. So it really had one just utterly dominant season in Seattle. And the last two were a bit of a struggle for him, and he was forced to retire after the 2009 season, but he still had one heck of a career. Without those injuries, we might be having a little different discussion here, because he was a real sack master, and just it was fun to watch the tenacity he had. And I also just, I really like the guy because of what he's done since he's retired, gone out and gotten a degree from Columbia. Extremely intelligent guy, so good for him that what he's been able to do since injuries shortened his NFL career. When Rob and I return from the break, we've taken a glance at the All-22. We'll discuss some observations from Sunday's loss to the Ravens. We'll be right back on the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm Corbin Smith alongside my co-host Rob Rang. The Seahawks dropped their second game of the season on Sunday, a 30-16 defeat to Earl Thomas and the Ravens. Thomas comes back to Seattle and wins in his homecoming at CenturyLink Field. The game was tight throughout. It was 13-13 at halftime. End of the third quarter, it was really close. And then the fourth quarter, the Seahawks just kind of fell apart. So the score shows that it was a little more lopsided than what it really was.
Absolutely. I mean, Seattle won in just about every single statistic other than turnovers in the final score. It's just the same story as against the Saints. I understand there's a lot of people who are, kind of crying in their beer, so to speak, about the outcome of this game. But, you know, to me, it was an encouraging game that if Seattle stays on pace, doesn't turn over the ball, then they can compete with anybody. Because I think that Baltimore really is a unique team because of Lamar Jackson. You look at they limited Lamar Jackson to 9 of 20 passing. I mean, so, you know, exactly what we talked about, Corbin, in our preview of the game. How do you beat this team? You have to force him to beat you with his arm rather than his legs. And fortunately, tip of the cap to Lamar Jackson, he was able to do so with his legs. And then, again, Seattle coughed up the ball twice, gave up 14 points. And so it's not surprising that that was the outcome was determined by those 14 points.
When we look back at Russell Wilson's season, what he had done going into this game, and he'd been perfect, no interceptions, and unfortunately he threw about the ugliest interception that possible to give himself his first one of the season, and Marcus Peters jumped it first game as a Raven. Marcus Peters is a player that we've talked about Russell Wilson's had a lot of success against in the past, but Peters is also a very good player, and he kind of, I don't know if you want to use the word baited. When I watched it live, I thought he baited Wilson a little bit, but it ultimately looks to me like Wilson just waited way too long to get that ball out there to Jerron Brown, and he also missed a wide-open DK Metcalf on a fade from the slot, and I'm sure that's one that Wilson's just kicking himself over when they went back and looked at the film, but you've got to move on from that, and of course, the late fumble by Metcalf, and the weather was nasty out there. It was trying to move the ball to his left hand, slips out, and the Ravens return it for a touchdown. So with those couple plays, it turned a game that was knotted up into a two-score victory for the Ravens. But what really stands out to me, there are obviously a lot of negatives that we could talk about here. Kind of an odd game plan at first, throwing the ball a lot when it's raining. The run game was finding traction early. Then when they tried to get back to it, they had a much tougher time in the second half trying to move those big boys inside. As we talked about going into the game, that was a concern for Seattle's front line. But I thought the pass protection, protecting Wills, and he got hit 7 times, but a lot of those were after holding onto the ball for a long time and he just couldn't find a receiver. I thought, again, with 2 guys out from that starting offensive line, that they did a pretty darn good job keeping him clean. And unfortunately, the secondary for Baltimore did a great job staying glued to receivers and they couldn't get open.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the reasons why I thought that Seattle might be looking at the receiver and possibly tight end market, as has been reported. It's just because Seattle's receivers and pass catchers were unable to consistently get open against a Baltimore secondary that I thought, while very, very talented, obviously, as you mentioned with Peters coming over, that there was going to be a team that hadn't developed any real cohesiveness, and perhaps the Seahawks would be able to take advantage of that. But the pass protection to me was one of the things that I was very very pleased with. You know, people just kind of forget that, George Fant is coming over there and trying to replace a left tackle that's a Pro Bowler in Dwayne Brown. And you have Jamarco Jones that, you know, is making that transition. I mean, Pete Carroll just, you know, just lauding praise on Jones, you know, for all of his terrific play so far. I mean, that's big time stuff. I mean, you're going up against a very talented defense, and one that prides itself on its defense. And so, again, while it's disappointing, obviously there's no amount of sugarcoating is going to give Seattle a victory here. If all you did is see the score, 30-16, you'd think that Seattle got toasted at home. But that was not the case. So this was a game that was as competitive as it can be. It's why I do believe that Pete Carroll was right to call the you know, go for the long field goal, because this was a competitive game that was absolutely winnable. You just had the two turnovers that absolutely broke your back.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. I would have taken a more aggressive approach there, but I can understand. The uproar that some people are having, acting like that was completely ridiculous to go for that field goal. Now, if they would have punted there, I would have had major issue with that. You either try the field goal that's in Meyer's range or you go for it. To me, that is not an area, even in a tied-up game. You're past midfield. I think you got to be aggressive against a really good football team like that to get your victory. So while I would have probably gone for it, the field goal to me was not quite – the weather maybe made it a little more questionable, but I can understand the decision. Like I said, he mentioned punting, then I kind of got lost a little bit there. Like, that's not my cup of tea in that situation. But you know what? That's the way that Pete Carroll has usually played those situations. He's had quite a bit of success, so I'm not going to sit here and second guess him on that. On the defensive side of the football, we've brought up Lamar Jackson a bunch the last couple days. It really is like trying to defend Madden 2004 version of Michael Vick, except it's in a real football game. I can't tell you how many times the Seahawks had guys back there that looked like they were in position to bring him down in the pocket, and he's like a magician, just like Russell Wilson, except he's even more athletic than Russell Wilson. He's got that straight line speed that you just simply cannot teach, and the elusiveness and space to make guys miss. Jadeveon Clowney had a couple times it looked like he was going to have him dead to right, and then next thing you know, he just turns and runs away from him. I mean, what are you going to do? Jadeveon Clowney is as athletic as any defensive end in football, but he's not going to be able to run with that guy. And yet, despite giving up over 110 rushing yards to Lamar Jackson, the defense only gave up 16 points. The Seahawks are going to win 95% of their games that the defense gives up 16 points. The only way they're going to lose those games is if the offense decides to be friendly and give up points. And like you said, that's exactly what happened in this game.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and again, it's tip of the cap to Jackson, and I think that you articulated it well. It's not just a straight line speed. There's been really, really fast guys in the past, including at the quarterback position. Michael Vick's the easiest one, but there's been other guys that don't have the elusiveness, the spatial awareness, and then of course the accuracy down the field.
And he's tough. He's tough. You know,
he's always been tough. That's the thing. He's such a terrific player. I mean, we kind of talked off the air a couple of times that literally my dog's name is Jackson, and it's because he is the fastest, most athletic dog I've ever seen in my life. And we got him the same year that Lamar Jackson won the Heisman Trophy, and that's not that I named my dog after a quarterback or anything, but at
yes,
the same
you
time,
did. Yes, you
well,
did.
It's not just Lamar Jackson. It's guys like Bo Jackson and, you know, and Reggie all Jackson. Right. I mean, all the great athletes who were just a different level. And yeah, Lamar Jackson is among them, and my Jackson, the German Shorthair Pointer, is among those as well. So it's to me, it's a joy to watch the elite athletes. Yeah, if it happens to cost the team that you're covering a win, then that's okay, because I just love watching the phenomenal athletes in this world compete, and that's exactly what Lamar Jackson did, and that's why I keep saying, hey, tip of the cap to one of the elite athletes I've ever seen in my life.
That's one of those instances where it doesn't matter who you're rooting for. That's a guy that you are just, you're going to stop what you're doing and you're going to watch every time he's got a football in his hands. And he also, you know, it was kind of a weird game for him throwing the ball, because he really kind of got screwed over by his receivers, especially Mark Andrews, who's normally really reliable. He dropped like four or five passes in this game. And yeah. So his numbers passing the football could have been a lot better. So I guess we can say that's a little bit of a sigh of relief for the Seahawks, maybe, that couple of those throws did not get completed. But on the flip side, there were also a couple big plays that happened primarily because of defensive breakdowns, and that's maybe what led the Seahawks to make this trade today for Quandre Diggs. Seeing what Tedrick Thompson did back there, allowing Miles Boykin to get by him for a 50-yard reception, a couple plays like that, you take those out of the equation, and Seattle basically shut down their passing game. So, again, a lot of positives on both sides of the ball. But Pete Carroll's mentioned this a couple times in the past few days. It's all about the football, and when you're coughing it up and the other team's getting points off it, good luck winning the game, especially when you don't have any turnovers yourself.
Exactly. And that's what it comes down to, is that Seattle was unable to create any turnovers. So there's a lot of people out there who are going to freak out about the lack of sacks. I don't freak out about the lack of sacks in that particular game. It's going to be very, very difficult to sack Lamar Jackson. You're just hoping to contain him, to steal the old Dan Patrick line. But at the same time, I am concerned about the lack of turnovers for us in this game. Lamar Jackson did throw some footballs up there that were potential interceptions. I mean, the one to Boykin, you know, early on in the game, that was the one that everybody is citing as far as one of the reasons why Tedrick Thompson may have lost his starting job. That was a possible interception right there. I mean, that could have absolutely turned the game from the get-go. And that's what Lamar Jackson will occasionally do. And so the fact that Seattle was not able to take advantage of that is very disconcerting, in my opinion. And you mentioned about with Mark Andrews, and I just wanted to kind of give some numbers to kind of prove that point. He was the receiver, the pass catcher for Baltimore we were most concerned about in our pregame kind of analysis. He had 8 targets, only caught 2 passes. I mean, Seth Roberts, the wide receiver, was the second most targeted guy. He had 4 targets. He only caught 1 pass for 9 yards. They shut Lamar Jackson down in the passing game. They just didn't get the turnovers they gave up to, and that's why they lost.
Yeah, and they also had a couple back-breaking runs that Lamar Jackson made that extended drives, too. And like Carroll was saying yesterday, you know, just got to tip the cap to him, because that you can't contain that dude. And it just goes back to the greatness of him as a ball carrier. And as he continues to develop and improve as a passer, good luck for defenses trying to defend him. But the Seahawks did plenty of good things, and they held him to several field goals, too, on drives that looked like they were going to give up 6. They held him to 3. So this game to me is not on the defense, as much as it stunk watching them get carved up by a quarterback that has once in a generation athleticism back there. And he's going to do that to pretty much every defense he faces for the most part. If he's able to get out in space, he's going to run around and through, you know, I'm even going to say through people, because he had a couple runs that he finished with authority in this game. He's just a dynamic talent. But the Seahawks were still able to hold the Ravens down to 16 points. You should win a game when you do that, and it's just the turnover battle. I'm not concerned about the sacks, like you said, in this game. I am getting concerned about it, though, from the season standpoint, just because we're now 7 weeks into the season. They have not been able to get this thing rolling. 3 of the past 5 games, they have no sacks. And honestly, they shouldn't have had any sacks in this game. Lamar Jackson got sacked by a wet turf in this particular game. It was not Jadeveon Clowney. It was not LJ Collier. I mean, Collier was on the ground when it happened, but I don't think they credited him with that. But somebody, I think Brandon Jackson actually got that sack, even though he was not even near him when he slipped and fell. But this team has got to figure that out. And I guess this is my one caveat to that. The one thing that can still provide some optimism here. The Seahawks have not played a game yet with Ziggy Ansah, Jadeveon Clowney, Jaren Reed, and Quentin Jefferson all active. And that is their best 4 rushing the pass from the defensive line. They have not had a game yet with all 4 of those guys. So until then, maybe it's not fair to completely try to judge this group. But we are at the halfway point of the season, and that is definitely an area they got to shore up if they want to compete in the NFC. If you're not going to be able to rush the passer at all, you are not going to be a legitimate contender in the postseason against some of the offenses that they are going to be facing. They're going to have to ramp that up here the last 9 games of the season. You can't do it. It's just not going to be able to get you to your potential, I don't think.
No, I agree with you. I mean, because as you get to the playoffs, and you're going to be going up against the elite quarterbacks. But I would say this, and again, I don't want to use another Pete Carroll cliche here, but, you know, can you win a game in the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter? I mean, there to me, this is an ascending team, and that's always an exciting thing. It's something that has been a trademark of Pete Carroll teams in the past. I just think that, you know, barring injury, I think that this is a team that is going to be very, very dangerous come December and January, and that's exactly what Seahawks fans want.
Well, hopefully your optimism comes true, and this has always been a second-half team. They always seem to play better in the second half since Pete Carroll's been here, so if that holds true, then yeah, this could be a team that pass rush wakes up, and now suddenly they're the team nobody wants to play late in the season into January. Make sure to follow me on Twitter, at CorbinSmithNFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. If you'd like to be a featured sponsor for our podcast, contact me, LockedSeahawks@gmail.com. Subscribe to our show if you haven't already. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is. You can do that by visiting our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. Tomorrow, it's Crossover Wednesday. I will be teaming up with the Locked On Falcons crew, and we'll be breaking down this upcoming game in Atlanta and taking a look at what's really went wrong for the 1-6 Falcons as they prepare to face the Seahawks. Hope you'll listen in. Go Hawks.